Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa. Today, we're going to be discussing the Trump administration's efforts to reach a mineral for peace deal in Central Africa, Congo to be, DRC to be specific. I'm joined by a very special guest, Thomas P. Sheehy, a distinguished fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace African Center, and he currently serves as a principal at Quinella Global, a consultancy company that is based in Washington. Mr. Sheehy has an extensive experience that spans over two decades, and previously served as staff director of the Africa Subcommittee in the U.S. House of Representatives for over 20 years. He has also previously directed the Terrorism, Non-Proliferation and Trade Subcommittee, which identified China's predatory commercial practices in Congo. Tom, it's a pleasure to have you join me. I'll give you the opportunity to expand on your experiences before we get into this sticky subject.
Oh, thank you, Michael, and thank you for the privilege to spend some time with you. No, as you mentioned, been involved in U.S. policy towards Africa for decades now, and particularly in the Congo. And so I was a staffer on the House Foreign Affairs Committee on the Africa Subcommittee right about the time that Mobutu fell as president of then Zaire. And so we had a chance to travel there and visit Kinshasa right after the fall of Mobutu. And right as Kabila was coming into Kinshasa. And as we know, at that time, Rwanda had intervened into Congo. And we saw from that point on all the chaos and the conflict in Eastern Congo. And unfortunately, that's been continuing to this very day. And so I think it's very important as we think about the opportunities and developments today that we have that historical perspective and realize again that this conflict has been decades in the making, and it's going to take quite a considerable effort to address and turn around.
Interesting. So we'll touch on the historical side in a minute, but let's start from the, I think it's better to set the kind of like foundation and start off with the history. So this region from Zaire, known as the DRC, so rich in minerals, but one that is a long-standing conflict. They've had like two civil wars and perennial conflict that continues till today. What is the history? Like you've already set out in the introduction, it seems to have a very long history. Could you give us like a summary of this history? Where did it start from?
Sure. Well, as we know, there's conflict today, and the minerals aren't being used for the betterment of the Congolese people. It's important to realize it's always been that way. Of course, this was the Belgian Congo, in which we had exploitation of critical minerals, of timber, of all types of natural resources. And we had independence, we had Zaire created, we had the regime of Mobutu Sese Seko, which was not pretty corrupt regime, and their human rights were pretty much a non-entity back then. The Mobutu regime fell, and this it's very important to realize how the Rwandan genocide spilled over. And so, when the genocide happened, and and the forces of President Kagame came in, a lot of the Hutu rebels, folks who had been involved in the Rwandan government, fled to Congo, and that became a permanent source of instability and still remains to this day. And so that border for the last, ever since the Rwandan genocide, has been a real point of contention between Rwanda, which views the insecurity and the activity of these elements to be a fundamental threat to its security, and then Congo, which of course is concerned about the violence and the lack of its control in that region. And so while there have been different, it's ebbed and flowed, the violence, the fundamental is that it's been a very unstable region, and there's just been terrible human suffering. It's not just the violence, it's the suffering that comes through the violence and the fighting and the displacement of peoples, which is massive, and all the ills that come with that, including food insecurity. And so the numbers are really startling in terms of the number of Congolese people who have lost their lives over the last 30 years.
Brilliant. So in the summer, I was invited to a sort of meeting where the current foreign minister for DRC came here to London, went to France, you know, trying to garner international support against the M23 occupation of the eastern Congo. And shortly after the United Kingdom and the United States also came heavy in terms of some kind of limited sanctions on Kagame. And following up on that, there was some speculations that President Tshisekedi was offering President Trump some kind of like minerals for kind of security protection. We did an episode 4 months ago that looked at that speculation, but now it looks like it's come to reality, and that has been signed. How do you see the U.S. support and such? The kind of like mirroring the Ukraine kind of deal with Russia. How do you see that?
Yeah, no, you're right, Michael. And there was an offer that several months ago, and there has been some progress. And we had an agreement signed between the Rwandan and the Congolese foreign ministers. Now, the second part of that is what they call the Regional Economic Integration Forum. The idea is that critical minerals would be central to that. Now, I think there's a bit of misunderstanding, and understandably so, because a lot of this is done in confidential settings and isn't public. But clearly, the U.S. is motivated by the critical minerals, and our diplomatic engagement is being driven by that. And while there really isn't a quid pro quo of exactly, you know, if the U.S. does this on the security front, it will be guaranteed access to these critical minerals. What's happening is the U.S. is trying to drive a peace agreement, which would allow for an environment in which U.S. companies would come in and have access to critical minerals and would have the support of the Congolese government. And so, again, it's not so much an explicit contractual basis type thing where a U.S. company is granted a concession if the peace agreement is signed. But that's definitely the spirit of it, that the U.S. would like to see U.S. companies come into Congo for two reasons. One, it serves U.S. critical mineral needs, but also, and I believe the Congolese believe this, it would be helpful to have a U.S. Presence in these sectors for a variety of reasons. Right now, the Congo is almost wholly dependent on China for mining activity. It would like to diversify. It would like to have multiple partners in that sector, including Europeans, but certainly including American companies. And so it's part of a complex framework that is showing some promise, but we're also seeing some slowdown in terms of acceptance, diplomatic acceptance. And so we're hopeful that we can keep up the momentum and get a real agreement, but it's going to take a lot of work.
I'm happy you mentioned China, and for someone that has also, you know, yourself, you've been on the committee and studied China's approach in that region. Now, if we look at it, we also had on the show, we had the former national speaker of DRC. And she had a different perspective to China's presence in the region. So my understanding or my reading, it seems that the U.S. once has hegemony or had some significant control over the critical minerals in DRC and lost that hegemony to China. Now you've mentioned that some of them, one of the motivation for U.S. there is also to check China's predominance in that region. Now, if one of the things in the conferences I've attended is also, is Western nations in trying to counter that China's advantage in terms of the control of critical minerals in there, are willing to sacrifice human rights conditions that is like the hallmark of liberal democracy. How do you speak to that? Also looking at what you said earlier on about Mobutu and the human rights conditions, and is there an irony here?
Well, no, great point, Michael. Clearly, it's obvious the U.S. is motivated by broad geopolitical concerns about China. China, and it's not just the U.S., it's all countries. China has created dominance over many, many critical minerals, and that's an economic vulnerability to countries worldwide, and they realize that. Now, China dominates the Congolese mining sector. It has 90% of the cobalt mines it processes 90% of the cobalt worldwide. It has the vast majority of mines in DRC. The U.S. would like to get involved in DRC because it helps strengthen their access to critical minerals, their supply chains, but it's simply not realistic to think that the U.S. is going to displace China and Congo. They've been there for 30 plus years. They developed deep roots. It's part of the fundamental mining infrastructure. And the Congolese don't want to displace China either. What the Congolese would like, again, is competition. They don't want to only have to sell their minerals to China. They want options. They also recognize, and this goes to your point of human rights, that while they're not perfect, generally speaking, U.S. companies bring higher standards, higher environmental standards, labor standards, and so forth. And so the hope is by attracting U.S. companies, by attracting other Western Japanese companies, European companies, over time, and this is all going to take a lot of time, the standards of mining can be raised. And I don't think anyone believes that China doesn't have problems when it comes to how they treat the environment and local workforce and other aspects of their business operations. So again, the idea from the Congolese perspective is to diversify, get more investment, different types of players in there. From the U.S. standpoint, it's let's try to work with the Congolese, get investment, develop supply chains through Congo. Now, some of the rhetoric would suggest this is a black and white thing. This is U.S. versus China. But I think anyone with looking at the situation as it exists on the ground recognizes, again, the U.S., it's such a small player right now in Congo. There's no way over a few years it's going to exceed China as a mining power in Central Africa.
There's another irony as well that I'd like you to speak on. It's the position of Rwanda and M23. So Rwanda is also a strong Western ally in terms of intervening in Mozambique, for instance, and in other places, and also some kind of bilateral agreements relating to migration and stuff like that. So how does that complicate? How does this relationship, this with Congo, complicate the relationship with China? Is it possible? Can they create, if Rwanda is behind, or M23, Rwandan-backed M23 is behind some of this insecurity in this place? How is the United States and other Western going to navigate such, controversy or irony?
Yeah, no, but it's obviously they play a critical role. And generally, the Rwanda and the U.S. have had pretty good relations ever since the end of the genocide. And that's economic relations, that's military relations, and so forth. I think it's an asset. Clearly, pressure has to be brought on both parties, and that's what the U.S. is doing. And I think that pressure can be brought on Rwanda for that very reason, that there is a relationship there that has existed over the years. And so much like what the U.S. has been doing in the Middle East with relations with Israel and relations with countries that have relations with Hamas, that this takes exerting pressure on all the parties. It's been a terrible situation for the last 30 years. And as I said, millions of people have died. It's time to try something new. I think this approach in which we look at critical minerals, we look at regional economic integration, is a different approach. It gets beyond the just talking about politics. It gets into talking about fundamentals of economic interests, which in some ways are probably stronger than the political interests. And it requires putting pressure on both parties. If we're going to move forward, DRC needs to do some things. Rwanda needs to do some things. They haven't been doing them on their own. And so I think, again, who knows where this is going to go? It may not succeed. This is a really difficult situation. But I think on balance, it's helpful that the U.S., and it's not just the U.S., it's Qatar, it's the African Union. There are a lot of players who have a role to play here in pressing on both parties to make the kind of sacrifices, compromises that are needed if we're going to get some momentum going. And again, this is going to take, there's no silver bullet. There's no magic moment where we sign a peace agreement, we're going to have peace. It's very deceptive to think of that way. These problems have been decades in the building. It's going to take decades to solve. But what we can do is hopefully stop the killing in the immediate term and start building slowly the momentum, changing people's incentives so they're more interested in peace than war.
Yeah. I'm glad you mentioned Qatar. That was going to be my next question. You kind of preempted my next question and the Middle East piece. So I think before, shortly before that, Qatar also facilitated a peace deal between Congo and Rwanda. I think Qatar has a good relationship or economic interest in both of these countries. So we've been seeing middle powers as well having inroads in Africa, not just economically, trying to flex their power, negotiating peace and all of that. And then you've mentioned the multilateral, the African Union and all of that. But again, we see also, whilst we talk about that multilateral, the need for multilateral approach, we also see maybe from the US or maybe it's the Trump administration, we see some kind of like nationalist drive, maybe American, America first, or, trying the UN, the decline of the United Nations and multilateral organizations and all of this. So again, these are kind of like contradictions. How do you explain all of these contradictions?
No.
How does it complicate the peace, the eventual peace?
Yeah, it's a complicated situation. Every country is going to be different. But Michael, keep in mind, we've had the United Nations involved in the Congo for decades. Again, we've had a peacekeeping force in Eastern Congo. The role of the United Nations in Congo goes back to the independence era in the early 60s. But again, in Eastern Congo, we've had a peacekeeping force. It just hasn't worked. It hasn't effectively ended the fighting. We've seen it intensify, and we've seen more suffering by the Congolese people. And so again, it was time to try something new. I think it's important to realize too that it's not very visible, but I'm here in Washington. I can tell you that the U.S. has been putting in a lot of time and effort into this peacekeeping agreement. Congolese officials, Rwandan officials, others have been spending weeks in here in the U.S. having talks, trying to work out the particulars of the regional economic framework, of the various components of the peace agreement. And so... This has been the number one priority for the Trump administration when it comes to Africa, trying to resolve this conflict and trying to encourage U.S. companies to get involved in Congo. U.S. companies traditionally have not been involved in this sector. And so it takes a lot of work by the U.S. government to entice companies to come in and make investments, because right now the perception is Congo is a war-torn country with poor infrastructure and political instability. And so it doesn't scream out, invest here, invest here. What's required is the U.S. government going to American companies, often working with European companies, others, to say, listen, there's some real opportunity here in Congo. We're working for peace. We're going to be with you if there are any problems to smooth out any kind of tensions, any type of problems with the government and so forth. But it's going to take time and take considerable effort.
Let me look at that in parallel to similar stuff happening in another troubled region in the Sahel. So we've seen in the Sahel where we now have, I think, about three military regimes in Mali, Mali, Niger, and Burkina Faso. So, but we've also heard speculations. I think the Trump administration is also considering similar mineral deal for security with this authoritarian government. Now, if we look at the lessons that I've learned with the expulsion of the French and eventually the expulsion of the United States, losing the drone base in Agadez, in Niger, and all of that. What lessons? Again, you're saying that the United States is trying to convince investors in this, and then they've lost millions of the base in the. What lessons, what parallel do you see between the DRC and the Sahel region?
No, I think things are a little different in that in the Sahel region, you have outside actors. You have Russia very involved in stirring the pot. You've got jihadists who have moved across the Sahel after the conflict in Libya and the instability there. And so it's more of a outside generator. I mean, I guess you could say, obviously, with Rwanda and Congo, I think the sense here in Washington is the opportunities are greater in the Congo, given the importance of copper and coltan and some other critical minerals and the dominance or the importance of those minerals to the energy transition, to the U.S. defense industrial base. And so I think really the focus has largely been on Congo. There's been some interest in the Sahel. It's a tough situation, and right now I don't quite see the economic push by the U.S. to get involved in those regions. That's not to say that individual companies won't be involved, but the force, the mass in terms of interest on Congo, that's where the focus is right now by Washington.
So I haven't studied conflict in Africa. Look at liberal democracy, capitalism, free market in the last, let's say, 60 years or so, and also seeing what I'm seeing now. I've always in my work look at interests. I've always said that there are strategic interests. There is no altruistic intervention. There's an intervention. Everyone has an interest. So if I look at Trump exemplifying that American interest in a way that we've not seen before, whereas interventions are always couched in a human rights, foreign aid, and stuff. But now Trump has come up like, no, this is business. This is, you know, what I'm saying more is like Trump's transactional approach. So do you think that's going to be the way forward? Is that going to be the template for how the U.S. and the Western nations deal with Africa moving forward?
It certainly will be for the duration of the Trump administration. That's his approach. And you're right. It is different from the Biden administration and previous U.S. administrations in terms of being focused a little more explicitly on interests, on commercial transactions. When it comes to Congo, Michael, I'm okay with it. I'm not so much concerned about the motives. I'm concerned about the actions and the results. Mm-hmm. And I think we saw for decades not all that much action. And again, we saw the continued human suffering. And so if the U.S. perceives itself as having strong interests in Congo, and it realizes that those interests can't be advanced unless there's peace, I think that's a good thing. And that's what the Congolese want. You yourself talked to the Congolese, and what do they want? They want U.S. investment. And so what the Trump administration is trying to do is to drive that investment, but again, linking it with peace and security. Because if we're honest, U.S. companies aren't going to go to Congo and invest there if there's instability. And so I think what the Trump administration has done is it's brought this new element, this new recognition that to have peace, you need to look at the economic interests, because they can strengthen peace or they can undermine peace. And if the incentives, if the actors are economic actors, don't want peace, then it's going to work in the opposite direction. And so this is a new approach. What it's trying to do is to recognize economics matter. What are the current economic framework, and is it driving peace or is it driving conflict? Right now, I think it's driving conflict. And so we want to get more actors in. We want to get actors who bring higher standards of business operation, who don't engage in corruption, who don't pollute the environment, all these things. And hopefully that can, over time, change the state of play on the ground. But you're right. It's a different day. I still would hope that we would do a lot of the things the U.S. has been doing traditionally, which includes the health sector, education, because those are important, too. It's hard to have peace when you don't have people getting health services, educational services, and other social services. So I'd like to see it all come together. So I think there's a good mix between the old way and the new way.
You've touched upon what I was going to ask next, because we can, in considering some of the geopolitical competition or motivations, also discount the Western traditions or standards. Again, how does the U.S. differentiate its own approach from China? Because from my research, as well, I've had some postgraduate students that have researched into this and look at the displacement that's some of the methods of the Chinese has caused, in terms of mining and all of that, and people that have been displaced. So it's again, how does the United States approach mitigate? You've touched upon that a little bit. How do they mitigate against that, and how do they prevent, not add pile on the humanitarian crisis, but provide some kind of relief? You mentioned health, you mentioned stuff, but what other ways can they as well?
Well, I think it's important to realize that, listen, no one's perfect. And you know, U.S. companies, if you look throughout the history, there's been abuses, and there's no perfect company. But on balance, I think most people would look at Chinese companies, would look at Western companies, and again, say that the Western companies have higher operating standards. It's actually hard. Many U.S. companies don't want to go into Congo because they're afraid of reputational risk. They're afraid that they'll be associated with some of these abuses, with artisanal mining, with kids in the mines and so forth. And so the hope is that, you know, those companies are only going to go in and operate in Congo if they can operate in a way that avoids those abuses. And so, again, the burden is almost on convincing companies that they can go in and operate in the DRC, and they're going to be able to avoid the abuses. So I'm fairly confident that, and I think we already see it, that the U.S. companies that are involved do raise the standards and will recognize the local communities need to see a tangible gain from the operations. It can't just be a mine and the minerals are shipped out and there's no no benefit to the local community. So I do know, having worked with a lot of U.S. mining companies, that they are very sensitive to creating situations, investing in the local communities so that they see the benefits. And again, that's education. But there's no, you know, it's a challenging environment. I think we have to recognize that. There's conflict, there's lack of infrastructure, there's lack of rule of law in some places. And so I hope that U.S. companies do go to Congo. I hope they bring their higher standards. But again, it's not going to be perfection overnight. These are tough environments. These are problems that have been in the works for decades, and it's going to take a long, long time. But I am hopeful. What we want to see is just stop the killing, get some new investment, get people talking to each other, and just turn things around so we're moving in the right direction as opposed to the wrong direction.
Do you think there's going to be a chance of the United States ever working or cooperating with China in, or is the competition going to be, how does the United States call the lead, China's lead in there? Is there going to be at a point where there might be some cooperation?
In the Congo?
Yeah.
Or in general?
In the Congo and in general as well.
Yeah. Well, in general, I think there will be. Obviously, it's the world's first and largest economy and second largest economy. And so there is a tremendous amount. We may not call it cooperation, but interaction. So that's just a reality. I mean, we have U.S. companies investing in China. We've got, despite all the many tensions that we see, there are various elements of cooperation going on all the time, I think. What people would like to see is more cooperation and tamp down some of the elements of competition and even hostility. So it's a very complicated relationship. You've got cooperation, you've got active aggression at the same time. In the Congo, I don't necessarily see much cooperation. I do think the reality of operating in Congo is that U.S. companies would have to interact with China, whether it be sharing infrastructure for transporting minerals or for energy generation or distribution. China has such a dominant position in the Congolese mining sector and have been there building relationships and building infrastructure for so long. My own view would be if a U.S. company needs to access a Chinese piece of infrastructure or have Chinese company as an offtaker for production, I don't think that should be a deal killer for the U.S. When you're trying to compete with someone who's so much more active in that region, sometimes cooperation may be to your benefit. I just hope the U.S. brings a realistic viewpoint that you can't exactly go into an environment that's been absolutely dominated by China and operate without potentially some interaction with China. And if it works to your advantage, all the better.
Yeah, I do agree, because it's a very core truth. Competition can be worse for Congo, for the conflict in Congo. But before I come to the last question, I was going to ask you, if you look at regional players and continental players like the African Union and also IGAD and the regional government in there, and also within the framework of African solutions to African problems, and also the recent campaign for Africa to move away from being a supplier of extractive materials to have some kind of like in the supply chain, to move up in the supply chain. How do you see all of that? Is that just mere rhetoric, or how do you see that
happening? No, it's an aspiration, and it's an important aspiration. It would be great if Congo could do more processing of its critical minerals in Congo. And I think the U.S. supports that. It's going to take time. And one thing we haven't even mentioned is whole Lobito Corridor, which is a major multinational effort, including the U.S., to to drive development through Angola up into to DRC and into Zambia. But part of that, Michael, is to create an environment, an economic corridor that has so much more than just a rail car shipping out copper and cobalt. It has agricultural development. It has infrastructure, information technology infrastructure. And so I do believe there is an effort and an understanding that to build a mutually beneficial partnership, Congo has to see more benefit. And that includes local processing of its critical minerals. Again, it's going to take time to do that. That's very energy intensive. You need good infrastructure. You need trained personnel. But I do believe that on balance, U.S. companies, the U.S. policy approach is much more sympathetic, much more supportive of that than the Chinese model. China's had 30, 40 years of opportunity to develop that model. It hasn't. And so you're seeing Congo take actions against China. They've imposed a cobalt ban because they feel like China's been manipulating the price. So there's a lot of dissatisfaction amongst the Congolese with Chinese investment. Now, they're happy the investment's there, but they want to see the quality of that investment, the local benefit, a lot more substantial. And to do that, it's always helpful, again, to have other partners where you can have deals. you never want to be making a deal with just one person, one country. You want options. And so the Congolese are smart. They recognize that. And so they are doing everything they can to lure U.S. investors.
I agree. I agree 100%. Let me ask you the last question. So first, someone that has over decades, from the 90s till now, studied the DRC. What do you see? Do you have a positive outlook with the current situation? Do you see a positive change, or do you see how can you see, if you're to project with the current situation, the current approach, do you think the situations might worsen, or will it get better?
I'm hopeful. I'm also realistic about the challenges. I hope the Congolese and the Rwandans rise to the occasion, because as I mentioned, I believe that the U.S., and it's not just the U.S., it's regional partners, it's Middle East partners, are putting in an exceptional effort to try to make this work. I worry that if it doesn't work, the U.S. isn't going to stay engaged forever. I really sense this is a moment in time where people who have the best interests of their country in mind really need to step forward. And the Congo has so many strengths. The Congolese civil society has been such a positive force for bringing accountability and protesting abuses. And so the country is so rich in natural resources, but so rich as well in human resources, talented people, and they deserve so much better than what they've had, particularly in the eastern part of the country. And so I'm not going to say this is going to work out, because I can't say that. I don't know. But I do sense, again, that this is a fairly unique moment in time. And I just hope people seize the opportunity and the folks who aren't being constructive can be pressured into doing what needs to be done. And the potential, again, it would be, companies want to come. The U.S. wants to be engaged. And they just need to see some sense of progress and some growing stability in the country. And so I remain optimistic, but the world needs to keep focused on this, because, as we mentioned before, some of the suffering is just incomprehensible, and it needs to end.
Yeah, Tom. Well, Tom, that is our time there, but I really, really appreciate your rich insight into this, and I also share some of your optimism, although maybe with a little bit of caution, looking at the history of that region. But yes, we do hope for the best, and we'll keep an eye. But thank you very much once again for honoring our invitation I know it's quite early there in Washington. We're glad to have you. But thank you.
Thank you, Michael. I've really enjoyed the conversation and all the best.
Yeah, you too. Thank you very much. Have a great day.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you once again for tuning in to this week's episode. As usual, join me to thank Mr. Tomoshihi, our guest for today, for his very expository and insightful commentary and analysis of the Trump's administration mineral for peace there in the Congo, in DRC. Upon us, stay blessed, and I'll see you next week.